Welcome to this week's Reaction Podcast. I'm joined by Ian Martin, Reaction Editor, and Maggie Pagano, our Executive Editor. If you like what you hear, please do subscribe to our website, which you can find at www.reaction.life. So this week we're talking about PMQs and the contest between Starmer and Johnson, and then we're going to move on and talk a little bit about the economy. So Ian, you sketched the encounter today for the site. What was your take on it?
Well, going into this, of course, number 10 were absolutely determined that they wouldn't have a rerun of what has happened in the previous 2 weeks. You've had a new Labour leader who's done rather well, actually. I thought last week marmalised Boris, and they're determined this week that that wouldn't happen. So a lot of expectation on Starmer, who's been winning these encounters, and Boris's team had clearly put in a lot of prep into ensuring that he was more satisfactorily across the detail and was much punchier. And I have to say my conclusion was broadly that it worked. And we just discovered some quite interesting things about Starmer as a performer. I know when we're talking about the theatrics, I know that that annoys some people, and people say, well, you know, Tony Benn style, what about the issues? Stick to the issues. Yes, of course the issues matter, and it's really serious stuff that they're engaging in. However, the theatrics do matter because they tell you about the confidence and capabilities and weaknesses and strengths of the two individuals who both want to be prime minister. So I think it's worth paying attention to. But I thought Boris won this one, not resoundingly, didn't smash Starmer, but I thought he emerged on top.
Yeah, I mean, he clearly had been drilled to within an inch of his life a little bit, or practiced very hard, because he had some pretty ready-made rebuffs. And it didn't feel like he was particularly improvising, actually, which is normally, and this is what I've been thinking, observing it over the last few weeks, is that Boris is one of these politicians who, like the best demagogues, really thrives with the crowd. A lot of his speechifying is he'll pause and then he'll find some energy from elsewhere and from the people around him. And he'll be able to pick up the thread like that. And it chimes with his other great, I mean, it's a real political skill, that, which is to understand the assumptions of your audience and then to be intuitively react to them and elaborate on them. And that is a political skill that Starmer does not have. And he has other skills which, yeah, you know, look great when you're going in on something that's very detailed. But I do wonder whether the hype around Starmer, there needs to be a little bit of modification. He still is rooted in this sort of essential encounter between a natural politician like Boris and someone who is not politically minded, someone who's quite ruthless and forensic and all these words, but he hasn't got political instincts, I don't think.
I'm not sure. I would disagree with that to a certain extent, in that I think he's very, very political and impressively so. I mean that in a neutral sense, just as an observation. I thought Dominic Lawson in the Sunday Times last weekend put it really well in identifying the Starmer role model as being Harold Wilson rather than Tony Blair, because Blair's the last person who won an election for the Labour Party 15 years ago, a long time ago now. Everything tends to be seen through the prism of Blairism, and he's not that at all. We know he's a different kind of ideological animal, and he is more like Harold Wilson in his instincts, in that here's the guy who was the architect of Labour's weird referendum policy and encouraged the anti-Brexit crowd the entire way, and is anti-Brexit himself. But then when asked at the weekend whether there should be an extension to the transition, made it quite clear that there shouldn't be. Now, that's not Harold Wilson style. That's not because he has some great belief in Brexit suddenly. It's because he can spot the advantage here. He wants to hold the government to its promise to get a deal, and can then say at the end of the process, if there isn't a deal, well, you see that it's all very sad and the government has let everyone down and it's all a terrible mess. That's classic Wilson style politics. He's very good at that. But then, of course, the problem for Starmer is that Wilson was also fantastic at rapier responses and thinking on his feet and communicating a sense of connection with the working voter, for working class voter, for want of a better term. Blair less so. Blair's a different animal, and Blair could sometimes be a bit of a cold fish, a bit like Starmer appears. But Wilson just had that rapier, rapid, quick-wittedness. And that was what was curious about today. Starmer was obviously nervous, but at the point when Boris was vulnerable, you could just sense that this sort of anticipation from Labour people, not in the chamber, but people presumably tuning in on Zoom or whatever, that was the moment to flatten Boris. And he didn't. He fluffed his lines at one key moment where I think people were looking for the denunciation, the clip that would make the 6 o'clock or 10 o'clock news, and it didn't come. So he's not agile in the way that Wilson or Blair could be, but I do think he's quite clever politically. Maggie, you don't buy the Starmer hype at all, do you?
No, I don't. And whilst I agree with a lot of what Dominic Lawson says, I actually think it was a rather bad comparison, because Harold Wilson was actually a rather exciting character who had a lot of very exciting thoughts, white heat of technology, it was the 60s. There was an awful lot of sort of excitement and thrill about him, and he was overturning. Whereas Starmer is just, I mean, he reminds me when I used to cover county councils in Norwich, you know, sort of rather dull council leader. And I think the word forensic keeps being used, but that's only because everyone knows he's a lawyer. I mean, I don't find him sort of forensics. Otherwise, he would just grab something and then he would get Boris, because Boris can't do detail. So actually, he needs to be more of what the hype, what everyone wants him to be. And he is cold, and he needs to, maybe he fluffed it today because there was so much attention on Boris. And if he can't sort of hold Boris to account, then I don't think he's going to do very well. Yes. So I'm very disappointed in both of them. I mean, the whole.
But he doesn't.
Go back to the 70s and 80s and even 90s for a bit of thrill in the chamber.
Alistair, though, do you think that there is a route back for Labour under Starmer? Can you see a path through?
Yeah. So, I mean, when I was talking about political skills, I don't mean he doesn't have insight into politics. He clearly does, but he, you know, when you get into, you know, the red circle, he doesn't have that thrill. And what the Tories have successfully done in the way that Blair did is find an individual who's actually able to kind of surf on the wave of a sort of series of accidents which have led to changes in our culture. And Blair was so effective at that. You know, he was the right person, but there were years and years that led up to his victory in 97 that made, you know, that didn't make a Labour victory inevitable, but it made someone with his character, it gave him the opportunity to do what he did. And him and Boris are remarkably similar in the way they are, but, and I use the word demagogue not in a negative way. They both talk about the people, Blair very very famously, but Boris probably even more so. He chimes with over and over again. People say, "Oh, Boris, he is for the people." It was throughout the election campaign. I heard it repeated countless times on interviews and vox pops. Whatever his flaws, people say he's for the people. And that's because he was able to see that Brexit represented this massive break with the status quo, and he was able to kind of to surf on that shift. And I don't know if I'm making much sense, but Labour are now so removed, I think, from the common culture of the UK, particularly in England, that it will take a decade of rebuilding. And Starmer, I imagine, is the right person to do that. But he's not one of these epoch-changing figures who will come in and sweep away the remnants of the previous era. But there we go. That's a lot of that is a lot of this is contingent on the Tories not completely going into a death spiral, which they've been threatening to do for years. And Boris sailed along last year. Really, you know, a year ago we were talking about the Tories polling, 10-15% of, you know, Boris completely changed that. And he is the crisis now. He had the disease, he went to hospital, he suffered with it. He embodies what we're going through. He's taken on everything, these addresses to the nation on television, almost bypassing Parliament, all that. But I think Labour, the damage done by Miliband and then Corbyn is so deep to, in terms of where they sit with the aspirations of the common culture and of people throughout the country, that I just don't, I think it is a decade.
I just want to add to that, Alistair, I think you're right. And I think what it is about Starmer that I can't put my finger on. He doesn't have a story to tell. He doesn't have a sort of view or a vision of what he would like the country to be, which is sort of paradoxical, because actually there's a great debate within certain parts of the Labour Party, sort of blue Labour, which actually meets red Toryism on one side. And you don't get any sense that they've even looked at the last 10 years to see why they've been such a disaster, which is your point about, you know, they don't understand the common culture. It doesn't even seem to me that he's particularly interested in it. I don't know. A lack of ideas. That's my sense.
That underlied the... what really irritated me about Starmer throughout last year is it was very process-driven. A lot of the stuff he was saying, it was not seeing the bigger picture and not engaging with where the ideas were driving. And a lot of people miss the bigger picture. You know, I certainly didn't think that, you know, at times I thought Brexit was sunk and that there would be a kind of cultural coming together in the other direction for various reasons. A lot of people believe that. But I never felt with his... What was it about the European Union that Starmer liked? Was it the fact that we were entering into a dislocation with a set of rules that had been developed over a period of time? Or was it... I never felt there was... I find it difficult to explain. It's interesting. I mean, he's from Oxford, where a lot of my family are from, which is almost a suburb of London. It's not in the countryside. It's not really in London, but it's not a particularly remarkable part of England. In fact, it's... I don't know. I haven't really thought about it, but I think you're right, Maggie. There's this quality about him that's kind of indefinable, but doesn't really... It's like something doesn't fit, but...
He's managerial and process-driven and a lawyer, but there must be more. There must be a drive there. You don't want to be prime minister unless there's something really... We haven't seen it yet.
But to be fair to him, by the end of Harold Wilson's period, where he'd effectively won or come out in front in four elections and had dominated the political scene in the most extraordinary fashion, people were still saying what was it all about and what was the vision, and people were still saying that Wilson was an enigma. By the end of the Blair period, even despite Iraq, well, in fact, until you got to Iraq, there was this sense that Blair was the answer to a question that no one knew what the question was. He was just sort of there and superficially impressive, and the Tories were tired, and he was rather brilliant at communications. So I don't think it's entirely implausible that you could get quite a long way into the Starmer era without him satisfactorily resolving that vision, that vision question.
Yeah.
He seems to sit on a... ideologically, he seems to sit on a sort of soft left 1980s part of the ideological spectrum. I'm intrigued by how by his dexterity at surviving things. It's pretty, you have to be pretty ruthless to have obviously thought that the Corbyn experiment was a disaster, and that the people around you were complete muppets. But then to win as decisively as he did in the leadership contest, and then get into power in Labour Party terms, and then ruthlessly just eliminate opponents and try and reclaim the Labour machine. It's not about Blairites anymore, but reclaim it for something that's more recognisably traditional Labour. And he's done that in a few short weeks. I think the question we're moving on to talk about the economy, Maggie, is his real opportunity and advantage, I suppose, is that he's going to be doing all of this, holding Boris to account through the public inquiry, through the next few years, while the economy is going to be in a pretty shocking state, unless I'm wrong. I mean, how bad's it going to be?
Oh, gosh, how long have we got? It's going to be pretty horrific over the next six, 9 months, isn't it? Absolutely. We're going to see even higher unemployment. And then it sort of depends on people's behaviour and habits and whether the lockdown has changed the way people want to work. I mean, we've talked about this before. I've heard of countless big city law firms, publishing houses, banks, even Barclays Bank, sort of questioning, do we need these great big offices? Now, if half the city stays empty, and then the economy is, you know, it's not just in the city, but else that just using that as an example, you know, the hairdressers, the restaurants, the bars, the shoe repairers, all those local economies would just disappear, and it would be devastating. One economist I spoke to earlier in the week who predicts that a lot of people, probably up to a third, might well choose a different working lifestyle, which could knock about 100 billion off tax revenues. Now, if we see those sorts of shifts, my own thinking is that people are social beings and they'll want to get back to pretty much normal life as quickly as possible. So optimistically, maybe nine months to a year. It depends really what they also do with all the borrowings. If Boris Johnson and Sunak have implied that, you know, this is going to be pushed out like the Second World War. There's not going to be any attempt to, you know, to cut down on the deficit, is there? They're going to be able to string this one out. And it just depends how they manage that and people's living standards.
The assumption seems to be, Maggie, that they will... So the deficit's going to be vast of a scale, of a size that we've never seen really before, certainly not in peacetime. And that there doesn't seem to be any pressure, or very little pressure, certainly on the Tory backbenches, might be some in think tank land fairly soon. Doesn't seem to be much pressure for the deficit to be controlled. There seems to be a widespread acceptance that that is just going to have to happen as a one-off war-style, war experience-style debt that you just pay off over, as David Davis put it, over 50 to 100 years. Does that, though, bring with it, Maggie, the possibility or risks further down the line in terms of, you know, some people find the concept of inflation laughable at the moment, but inflation or even some sort of sovereign crisis, or is that remote?
Find it impossible to predict that. I mean, certainly we're not going to, I think inflation is going to fall through the floor. We're going to have zero inflation, don't you think, by the end of this year, but it could start creeping up again. And just, I think it depends how quickly we start rebuilding and we get confidence back and then foreign investment back into the country. It depends on so many variables. But I don't think it's going to be V-shaped.
Not going to be V-shaped.
No. It's more of a Nike tick, you know, sort of short, sharp, and then it will grow. But maybe I'm foolish to be so optimistic. People will want to start behaving and spending again not, I don't think perhaps at the same rate as before. I think there are a lot of behavioural instincts that will have changed. But people will still want to run companies, they want to start companies. And the most important thing actually is that we get all the, we have all the instruments available for people to be able to do that. I think that's going to be the key for policy.
And whether the disease,
so that people will be out there again, you know, people will be desperate, certainly below the age of 40, to be out there being economically active.
And not just that. I mean, as we're seeing, I think I genuinely, and maybe this is a over optimistic solution, this disease is it's not doing very well at the moment. Its deaths are falling rapidly. I think you look at the R in wide swathes of the country, it's even in places where it has lots of people to infect, the R is still, you know, below one. I think people will adjust their behaviour according to the risk. And if the risk falls, then things will get back to normal incredibly quickly. I mean, I was out on the common at the weekend and it's just like any other summer's day with big groups of people. And you just think, you know, were stadiums a year after the Spanish flu ripped through the whole of the West, stadiums in America were full for baseball tournaments. You know, I think people's behavior, there's a massive overemphasis over, oh, nothing will ever be the same again. Well, things will be slightly different, but as Maggie said, you know, social life finds a way to continue.
I think what we will see is some policy shifts. And I think there'll be certain industries now that will be more protected. And the obvious one is PPE. But I think there will be a re-evaluation of our takeover policy. So at the moment, it's defence, finance and media. I suspect there'll be more utilities, whether it's the internet or PPE, pharmaceuticals, will be onshored and brought home. I think there'll be a lot of changes in that sphere.
Boris was asked about that at PMQs today, where Richard Drax asked a very good question about the French are already sort of cracking down on and blocking takeovers, or there are suggestions that Chinese-backed companies are trying to buy into French defence firms that are potentially going to go bust during the crisis or the aftermath of the crisis, and the French are being really robust. And Boris was asked by Drax about it with an eye on Huawei as well, and stumbled a bit, but did essentially indicate that there is a policy announcement coming down the line on that. So I think you're right, Maggie, you'll see all manner of new rules and restrictions on this, and also state aid rules in EU terms, although we're still during the transition until the end of the year. All of that stuff will go out of the window. So I think you'll see a lot of state improvisation, not just in Britain, but across Europe. Not quite sure how the reshoring is going to happen, whether it, I mean, there are different views on this, whether it will be as dramatic as people thought maybe 6-7 weeks ago. You know, do you source less, you don't, obviously don't completely stop imports from China, but do you source less stuff from there and more stuff from a market or producer, say, on the fringes of Europe, like Turkey? Or does the state actually try and mandate certain industries, PPE being the most obvious, but all manner of other medical supply stuff and machinery, that it has to be British made? Or what counts as actually being robust in supply chain terms? A lot of people thinking about that at the moment, but I'm not sure. I mean, on the point about the rapid bounce back, I don't think there'll be a rapid bounce back for the economy, but in terms of socialising, I suspect you're right, Alistair, in that, well, I spoke to a Tory, well-placed Tory MP this morning who'd been chatting to government about it. And I think once you get through the next very awkward phase, which is dealing with schools, trying to relax the lockdown, the problems that they're having with test and track and trace, once you get through that, I think, barring something going spectacularly wrong, they're looking at July being a lot more relaxed, as in essentially you'll have most workplaces open, or all workplaces open, people observing certain amounts of social distancing. And it'll be concerts and very large gatherings that don't happen. But short of that, I think they envisage life returning. Yes. Does that sound credible, Maggie?
I think it does. And it will, again, open very... It will start very... Almost in the same way we had lockdown almost within days, even before the government announced it, you can sort of sense that people are on the leash and ready to be let go. And I think if Spain, Italy... Greece now have said that they're going to open the countries for tourism. You know, you can just see Michael O'Leary. He's going to be offering some, you know, great deals, and it will just take off very quickly. I have one question which I would love to see what you two think about and what will happen. And that is when we see the next round of public sector pay negotiations, particularly for the NHS. And I think this is something that perhaps people haven't thought about, you know, all the clapping on a Thursday, this absolute sort of in awe of the NHS frontline staff, which, you know, obviously they have been fantastic. But will they get anything from this? And will the unions try and push through for much higher wages, which, going back to your inflation point, whether we'll see some sort of pushback? But I can't see the public health unions just sort of taking the clapping without getting some greater reward.
No, I think you're right, Maggie. There'll be extraordinary pressure. That will be one of the stories of this autumn, won't it? You can imagine going into the winter, if you are looking at the possibility of a second spike, or people will at least be worried about, you know, will the virus in some form return? I think the atmosphere could be really quite fractious. I mean, I wonder to what extent the consensus on this will, whether it will survive the year or not, because if you are to apply this, and the government does seem determined to try and do something on pay for the NHS, do you also then do that for local authority waste disposal workers who've got through the crisis? Do you then try and mandate or force the supermarkets to do something similar on people who are stacking shelves and who've bravely worked through the crisis and have been part of the, you know, essential services that have kept the country going? Care workers as well is obviously going to be a really difficult question. Before you know where you are, it's a lot of workers in quite difficult circumstances with the country running a deficit that is off the scale. I'm sure on the NHS they will find a way, and what's a few billion more when the numbers are so vast anyway. But a lot of people will be clamouring for recognition or for increased wages. I think it'll be quite difficult for the government to
manage. They could do some easy, not tricks, but some simpler solutions. So, for example, nurses, you could get rid of all tuition fees for nursing and, you know, health related. Training areas. I would have thought that could be a really quite smart move to try and win over.
I wonder if they won't reverse some of the language of the city and borrow some of the language from the financial crisis, when people were so annoyed about bonuses and bonus seasons. I wonder if they won't wrap it up as a bonus for NHS workers. So that you might not, you might have a smaller increase, but also a one-off payment in recognition of extra hours worked and sacrifice. But I think if they'll create huge problems for in terms of wage inflation or public sector wage inflation if they build in a substantial across the NHS wage increase in England and Wales, and then don't do the same for local authorities and for teachers. For example, you're into a whole world of trouble, which seems impossible now when people are in the mood to go out and clap on a Thursday night and not get annoyed with each other. The autumn will look and feel different because the country will have a lot less money, and there will be. I don't know, where's unemployment going to land in 6 months? I mean, I hope I'm wrong, but it's 2.5-3 million. Maybe you're probably higher when you take in furloughed people who are furloughed, who will be who will then run the risk of being paid off. So in those circumstances, with millions of people out of work and many more suffering cuts and the rest, will they go for one section of the public sector and give them a whacking great pay rise? It's not any. It's not
where I would be slightly concerned is, I mean, we talked slightly about behaviour changes, and it's actually really important for lots of businesses. The government should, you know, if there are certain standards of safety, whatever they are, for the public sector, and the unions have managed to negotiate, or you know, a good package on that, there is a risk that the norms set there are actually really destructive. I mean, you take something like the 2 meter rule, which is, by the way, a synthetic rule. It's no evidence that 2 meters is better than 1 meter or even half a meter in some cases. I mean, it was a number set by a panel of experts because they thought it was easy to follow, not because it was exact. But the difference between 2 meters and 1 meter or 0.5 meters for like 10% of the economy decides whether they live or die. You know, you're either got four times many more people can use the service, or just compared to just 25% of that with the harsher rules. So I think we're going to have a massive discussion over what, and it started after the first easing of the lockdown. You know, what classes are going to have to go back to work and use public transport? What is safe? And how that all interconnects is really difficult. But I'd be slightly concerned if the government tries to over-determine behaviour changes, because it could just, you know, it never really ends well when people try and fiddle around with those kinds of rules. And look, in Italy, it's 1 metre and you can, pubs and cafes are already open and you can see they're almost full. I think that's perfectly safe.
Where do you think Alistair will land on things like theatres, galleries? Well, galleries are slightly different, but so theatres, football matches, major sporting occasions. Do they just have to wait until see what happens abroad, see what happens in other European countries or in Asia, and see if it, and just track if it makes a difference or if it creates future spikes? We can't really be looking at people, you know, below the age of 40 not being able to go to a concert or to a nightclub, below the age of 30 for the next year because we don't yet know the answer. Will those things just stay shut?
The problem is that the new evidence or sort of orthodoxy is that, you know, people have read a bit of panelists on Sage. They're now focused on what is on how super spreading works with this virus. So they think that roughly 10% of the people who have it account for 80% of the new infections. So it operates roughly like
10% to 80%.
Yeah, so it's roughly like gonorrhea, for example, if it lower the tone a little bit. 10% of sexually active people probably account for, you know, 80% of the new infections, because they're proportionally having way more unsafe sex. So, but it's the same with this virus. It seems to, a bit like SARS before, it was basically big events where lots of people were in one place at one time in close proximity, which facilitated like a huge proportion of the new outbreaks. They roughly estimate that it takes 4 undetected new sort of mini outbreaks before the spark happens and a mass outbreak happens, because it takes, you know, there's a bit of probability there. Everything has to come together for the mass outbreak to happen, and then it starts spiraling and going off in an exponential direction. But so in answer to your question, Ian, I think, you know, the new orthodoxy is large gatherings are just completely out, because you could potentially see potentially big outbreaks as a result. I mean, it's really sad to me. I mean, some places like, if we look at a concrete example, a place like the BFI, in terms of the cinema, will be fine. It could probably shut for ages because it's a big institution, probably got massive endowment. You know, I don't know. But small cinemas, the places that, you know, I speaking personally, when I used to live in East London, there was a little cinema I used to go to every Sunday. It was the highlight of my week. I absolutely loved it. They put on great film programs. About 10 people could fit in there. I don't see how that reopens, if at all. So all the little things that make a community work in terms of the creative things, I just look a bit doomed. And that's, I don't think there's a simple answer to it. Galleries will be fine, yeah. But I mean, on sports, I just don't think, you know, there's a price for everything, right? And I don't think lots of people outside is going to facilitate a massive outbreak. And you might as well take a risk, and because this is the index of our lives. Without it, without cricket, my life feels aimless. And I'm sure it's the same for everyone who supports sport and follows it. It's the way we track the passing of the years. Peter Pomerantsev wrote a brilliant piece about that in, I think, in Prospects, worth looking up. But, you know, I mean, what's the point of living if you can't go and watch your favourite team or go and play sport with your friends? I mean, or go and see a concert. It's just it's nothing at all.
Do we not think then that this virus would just burn itself out like most influenzas or coronaviruses do?
100%, I think.
Yeah, that's what I think.
But it's, I think people, there's this notion, for example, the second wave, this is a huge motif at the moment. We're just loosening and then there will be a second wave. Well, if you look at the evidence of when second waves happened over the last century, and I'll probably be damned by this and there will be a terrible second wave and it'll be a disaster and the prediction will be ridiculous. But for example, the Spanish flu second wave, I think people overestimate how much we actually know about the Spanish flu. Only three actual examples have ever been found of the pathogen that was the Spanish, of the influenza strain that caused Spanish flu. A lot of the deaths that are ascribed to Spanish flu are unknowable. This is just after the biggest, most cataclysmic war we'd ever seen in Europe. Malnutrition, terrible living standards, terrible levels of dirt and poverty and all the rest. You know, a lot of these deaths were probably semi-related to this or nothing to do with them. And the second wave as a result is in part a creative thing. So there's no guarantee that it will happen.
That's true. But the term, as you said, it's a creative term, which it is, of course. It's a media shorthand which people get into using, which simply reflects a very deep human fear, which is the fear of what happens in a plague, and human experience suggests that they appear and then they come back for reasons which you can't work out exactly why or how. I mean, we were pretty clueless and naive 3-4 months ago. So I think people are just having been too blasé about it, are just exercising some understandable caution. So I don't think people mean it in terms of that they understand the virus, and that they because of what happened with Spanish flu, the second wave, which is just, as I say, a convenient shorthand, is definitely going to be worse than the first. I hope you're both right. I hope it just fades away. I think we were talking there about mass gatherings, and I just wanted, we didn't get a chance at the top of the program, Alice, to just mention some of the sort of virtual mass gatherings, these events which we've just started doing on Zoom for Reaction readers and subscribers. And the next one, the last one, was with Matt Ridley on his new book, How Innovation Works, to which many readers and listeners to the Reaction podcast tuned into. And our next one, tickets are on sale on the site, is with Andrew Roberts, the historian. It's me and Andrew talking about history and leadership in a crisis. Talk about Napoleon, Churchill, Stalin, Hitler, and a bit of Boris as well. And Andrew will talk about lessons that can be drawn. So that's on the 27th of May at 6 p.m. from 6 p.m. until 7:15. You need a ticket to be invited to join it. But if you're listening to this and you think that sounds interesting, and Andrew's always, always stimulating and fascinating, sign up for a ticket. But I think we'll then draw things to a close, won't we, for today. And just stress again that if you're not a Reaction subscriber, as Alistair said at the top of the podcast, go to the site www.reaction.life and you can become a subscriber for £6 a month or £60 for the entire year. You get all the great work that the team do, plus you get my newsletter and you get invites to reader events of the kind that I described with Andrew Roberts, and subscribers there got a chance to buy early discounted tickets. So please sign up and become a Reaction subscriber. But until next time, thank you for listening.